This show is brought to you by OffWorldDesigns.com. OffWorldDesigns.com is the place where you can find the nerdiest t-shirts and more at prices that won't break the bank. OffWorldDesigns.com offers shirts from all fandoms and hobbies, and even some other pretty cool stuff like messenger bags that can hold your plus one sort of awesome and so much more. You can use promo code GEEKSRULE to get 10% off your entire order. OffWorldDesigns.com is a proud sponsor of ThisWeekInGeek.net.
My vision is clear, the future is here.
Hey guys, what's going on? You are listening to This Week in Geek, and this is actually a new show. This is the interview episode of a new RPG show I'm calling Botched Role. This is the show where I talk about some of my experiences with different RPGs, just kind of waxing philosophical on certain RPG, be it tactics, stuff you can do as a game master, as a player, whatnot. Just kind of expanding upon the content that I work with. These Warriors Are Terrible, now rebranded Terrible Warriors, which you should be hearing sometime in early March, which I think Steve is doing the D&D starter set, which is part of the Dungeons and Dragons 5th edition or next, whatever the hell you want to call it. You can look for that over on TerribleWarriors.com. But in this episode, like I said, I'm going to be talking to some people in the RPG industry. And this is a group of individuals who've been around since the very early 80s, 1981 if I'm not mistaken. And these are the guys from Palladium Books. That's a name that probably should sound very familiar to you, because these guys have done a lot in the RPG industry over the course of their 30-year plus history. These guys have done stuff like Rifts, which is a book you've arguably heard of. Have you played it? I'm not so sure. I remember hearing about a lot of my friends playing it in high school, especially my first game master, Jamie. But you may have also heard of their extensive involvement with the Robotech property. They recently released the Robotech RPG Tactics board game, which we recommended for hardcore fans in our holiday gift guide back in December. And they also have a bunch of other properties under their belt. And I recently picked up some of their books in the last year or so for TMNT and Other Strangeness, which is based upon the Ninja Turtles property, which actually, I'm surprised how old that game is. But on the line with me right now, we're going to be welcoming some of the big guys from over at Palladium. We're talking with President, Principal, awesome dude all around, Kevin Sambita, and also Jeff Burke, who has some extensive knowledge of the Robotech RPG Tactics board game, and just some general awesomeness as well. Guys, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks.
Nice to have. Glad to have us on.
Yeah, I gotta say, guys, when I started researching this for the show, I'm really just surprised how far the history of Palladium Books goes back. I mean, the company is what, 33 years old now?
Yeah, it'll be 34 this year.
Yeah, you guys are the same age as I am, and that's just incredible just to think. That just, you know, it's weird to see an RPG that's almost as old as D&D and yet has such, like, so many different properties underneath it, because the worlds you guys have created, not just with the Palladium Fantasy role-playing game, but stuff with Heroes Unlimited, TMNT, Robotech, and then Rifts in the 90s, and you guys have never really quite stopped.
No, we really haven't. And thanks for making me feel old, but I guess I am.
So I guess I have to ask, because for my listeners that aren't necessarily familiar with Palladium Books, give me the issue zero, the origin story of Palladium Books and when you guys really kind of got rocking and rolling into the RPG industry.
Well, I founded a company in 1981, and our first product was the Mechanoid Invasion, which was the first part of a three-part trilogy. I was 24, and I grew up poor in Detroit. So the game I actually wanted to start with was the Palladium Fantasy game. And I did not have the financial resources to do the game the way I wanted to. So I sat back and said, well, what can I do that could get the company started and build towards doing you know, my big game, which was Palladium Fantasy at the time. So we came out with the Mechanoid Invasion, which was a sci-fi kind of thing. And, you know, for those of you out there who have seen the book, you can attest to the fact that while I may be a very good game designer and writer, I spell like crap. And I think one of the frighteningly memorable things about the Mechanoid Invasion, which did go on to become a cult hit, which was cool, is that there's, and this is not an exaggeration, there are on average 20 typos a page.
Wow.
So, yeah.
And I thought I couldn't spell. I love it.
No, I was awful. I'm a lot better now, but when I was 24, not so much. And sort of the secret big success of ours that no one realizes is that we came out with this series of weapon books, Weapons and Armor, Weapons and Castles, Weapons and Assassins, and a few others. And it was back in the day before, you know, we're talking 1982, 1983, before the internet, before Google. And people simply didn't know what a lot of ancient weapons and armor and those types of things really were or what they looked like. You know, one of the big things that would go around all the time is people would read stuff, especially like in D&D, where it talked about a polearm or a halberd. And most people had no clue what the heck that was. And so we put together this book, spearheaded by one of my first guys who helped me start the company, Matt Ballant. And those little books are like little 48 page books, but they were crammed with stuff. Like the first book, Weapons and Armor, had something like 700 little line drawings of different weapons and which side was that it was the bladed side. And it was designed so that it could be used with any game system. And in like 3 or 4 years, we sold 100,000 copies of that book. And then I just kept sinking money back into the company. And in 1983, I finally had the finances to kick out Palladium Fantasy. And that was a hit. And we just kind of went out from there.
So how did you guys go about acquiring different kind of licenses? Because one of the things I've noticed with Palladium is you guys get some really cool licenses. Most notably, you picked up TMNT before it was this mega hit with the cartoon in the 80s. I mean, it was obviously the big cult comic book, but you also picked up Robotech not long after it had left the air as a cartoon.
Yeah, I had a lot of people talk to me about, gee, you've really got your finger on the pulse of the fan market. And I think that was only because, you know, I was a fanboy geek myself. With TMNT, it was a matter of I was a huge comic book fan. And I had heard about Turtles. I wanted to see Turtles. And that was pretty much just fate. So was Robotech. Because I finally got a copy of Ninja Turtles number 2 and had read it. I mean, literally got done reading it, put it down, and I get a call from a guy who says, hey, have you seen Ninja Turtles? I think it would make a great game, and I have some ideas to do this. And I'm like, holy crap, yeah, because I was just talking about how I thought it would make a great game. And we talked, and unfortunately things with that gentleman didn't pan out, but I brought Eric Woodjick in, who was a brilliant game designer, and said, Eric, this is what I think we need, what would make a great game. He and I discussed it for weeks and weeks and weeks, and then he just dived in and belted that baby out, and it was a masterpiece. And for us, it was our first big mega hit. You know, back then, if you you know, sold a game that had a press run of 5,000 copies, you were doing good. And I had a lot of faith in that product, so I pressed 10,000 copies. And we sold out in like 3 months, and then it just kept picking up as the you know, comic book got more popular. The game sold like crazy. We sold a couple 100,000 copies in the life of that game for like the 15 or 18 years that we had that license, plus a bunch of source books. And of course, the fun part for me was working with Kevin Eastman and Peter Laird, two awesome guys. I mean, their success you know, is well deserved. It could not happen to two nicer guys. I mean, they are just the best people on the planet.
So how did you luck into the Robotech legend? Like I said, you're a bit of a fanboy, and at that time in the 80s, anime was still something very new to the North American audiences. I mean, we'd seen some stuff. I mean, going all the way back to like Astro Boy and Speed Racer, but it really wasn't a huge thing until Robotech and the invasion of the really awesome animated shows kind of started making their way over here to the West.
Well, again, that's the thing as a comic book guy, because that was really my goal. In fact, it's funny, when I started Palladium, it was just supposed to be a temporary thing until I broke into the comic book industry. you know, we just got so successful and I enjoyed what I was doing so much, I just stayed with it. But you mentioned Astro Boy and, you know, some of the other anime of the day. I was into all that. But with Robotech, while I was familiar with Robotech, I had not actually seen the animated series. And one of the guys who was working for me at the time was Richard Burke, no relations to Jeff. And he had watched a show. And here in Michigan, it was being aired at like 4 a.m. And I guess he was taping it on VHS tape. And he comes in, he's like, Kev, you got it. This is perfect for the Megadamus system you're launching. And, you know, it's a great show and you got to see it. And I'm like, I'm not getting up at 4 a.m. And for some reason, I never even thought about, you know, just taping the damn show. So I'm like, nah, I'm not interested in this. And you know, maybe it's cool. And poor Rick Burke kept going, Kev, you got to see this. You're going to love it. You're going to want this. This is the next property you've been looking for. And I'm like, yeah, okay. And I just never got around to it. And then they switched it from 4 a.m. to 4 p.m. And so I watched like the first two episodes, because I think they were airing them back to back with my kids, who were like 4 and 6 at the time. And I just freak out, because it's amazing. And now I need to know everything Robotech. And, you know, I approach Rick and I'm like, Rick, why didn't you tell me this was so awesome? And he's like, but I did. I kept telling you it was amazing. I'm like, no, but you didn't press upon me that this is amazing. I've got to have this. And, you know, we tracked down who had the rights. And obviously I watched a lot more episodes and picked up everything I could. I was really lucky in that we had a couple of stores in the Detroit area that carried anime. And in fact, that's how I met Jeff Burke, who was like 16 at the time, because we frequented the same comic book store that specialized in a bunch of anime, both the videotapes and model kits and the Bandai, you know, transformable mecha, and that stuff just blew me away. I loved it. I mean, Jeff, did you want
to? Oh, I got nothing else to say. Yeah, I have fond memories of the old store for sure. Yeah, it was just kind of like that staging point that ultimately brought us together. So it was the store that we frequented at that point, I worked for, and it was one of the anime stores in the country. We used to get people that would come in from states all around us to hit that store, just because we were one of the few places that were big into the old anime scene. So,
oh, and I mean big. They had all kinds of awesome stuff. They rented tapes, and they had a great selection of toys and model kits. And the irony, or the interesting thing there too, is, you know, Detroit area has a lot of talented guys. The owner of that store was a gentleman named Gary Reed, who would go on to do Caliber Press, a whole series of comic books that came out in the 90s, and he hosted a couple of conventions, and all-around good guy. Helped start McFarlane Toys, as a matter of fact.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So, a question for both of you guys, because you guys are older than me, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but I mean that in the fact that you guys kind of grew up into what I consider to be some of the golden age of geek. You guys got to see the rise of so many RPG companies. You guys got to be a part of that RPG, basically, when I think it was probably at some of its best way back in the day, because there were so many books, properties, and a lot of people were playing. What was it like to be around during that time when things were really, really exciting?
Exactly that, Mike. It was raw excitement. I was super fortunate. Like I said, Detroit, in the 70s, Detroit was a hotbed for comic books. And there were conventions held all the time. So for me, being super deep into comics and being an artist, my original plan was I wanted to be a comic book artist and writer. So we had all these comic book shows in the 70s. I got to meet guys like Gene Roddenberry and George Romero and every comic book artist you can think of during the time, Neil Adams and Barry Windsor Smith. And I saw Jim Starlin's portfolio that got him hired at Marvel the weekend before Marvel did, because he was at this small convention and we were sitting around chatting, a bunch of artists, and he's like, well, here's my portfolio. I'm going to show Marvel. And we're like, wow, this is amazing. And the cool thing of that is, as the comic books kind of faded out, at least as far as conventions and things in our area, role-playing just kind of took off. And that's a thing that I just kind of fell into too, because one of my guys, Julius Rosenstein, he and I were working together at an art supply store in downtown Detroit. And he's the one who discovered role-playing and introduced me to it. And it's funny because the first couple of times I played, it was the original D&D, and I just hated it. I thought role-playing was stupid, and I just couldn't get it. I couldn't remember which dice to use, and I hated the, let's see, my armor rating is this, and I got to look at this chart, and, you know, the higher my armor rating, it's actually the worse it is, and, you know, all this stuff. And I'm like, this is just – and plus he tried to introduce us into an established group, and it was clear the Game Master in particular and the players weren't too happy to have, like, three or four new guys added to their group. So Julius finally says, hey, let me run a game for you guys. And he's a great game master. And that third game, it was just magic. And then Julius introduced me to, because we were right by Wayne State University in downtown Detroit. And there were a bunch of amazing gaming guys there. I met Eric Wujcik and a whole bunch of other folks there, Matt Ballant. And we started something called the Detroit Gaming Center, which was in a really bad part of town. I mean, we had Ladies of the Night walk in and drugs are being sold on the corner.
Oh, geez.
And, the Detroit Gaming Center was actually in a methadone clinic that had closed down.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. And, you know, we're all, you know, 20-something, so, you know, we didn't care, and we were indestructible. And I grew up in Detroit, so I wasn't afraid of, you know, Detroit at all. And the beauty of the Detroit Gaming Center was, I always think of it as sort of like a rainforest, where you just had this hotbed of talent and people and new ideas. And so the cool thing with having the Detroit Gaming Center around was that the minute a new product came out, somebody at the Gaming Center bought it. And it was there like 5 minutes after it hit the shelves, it seemed like. So we got to see every game. I got to see all kinds of different styles of gaming. We got to see all kinds of different ideas on how to take games and manipulate games and develop games and extrapolate on them. And it was just amazing. It was just really pure excitement. And then to see all these other game companies pop up, because probably in 1981, there were maybe a dozen. And by 1986, there were probably 200. It was fantastic.
Now, you spoke about developing games. And one of the things about Playdium books and the games that you guys produce is they're all relatively compatible with each other. So if I wanted to have a Veritech pilot fight a Glitter Boy who's a Ninja Turtle, I could in theory do this.
Oh, not in theory. You absolutely can do that. And that was very deliberate. One of the things that struck me during the early days of gaming was that people would immediately find a favorite game system. And then even within that same company, every time they came up with a new game, it'd be a different set of rules. And people would be disappointed by that. And people wished, gosh, can I include this with this? And it'd be nice if I could combine, you know, X, Y, and Z with all this other cool stuff. And I just sat back and said, you know, why not? In fact, there was a big debate at one point at the gaming center, whether you could even combine, you know, talk about how naive everyone was back then and how new role-playing was. The big debate at the time was, can you combine magic and technology and make it work? And I'm like, of course you can. And like I said, there's this huge debate among the people there. So I actually ran a tournament called Magic versus Technology. And that was a blast. And that kind of helped lead to everything else that we were doing.
So,
Go ahead.
I was about to say, so when you had all this compatibility, like I said, people wanted to have their own game systems and be able to own one system, but do multiple things with it. What are some of the unique creations you've seen over the years? Like I said, the fact that I could have a Veritech fight a zombie and a Ninja Turtle is something I've never quite really seen in any other game before. The fact that everything works together and plays so nice together.
Thanks. Well, and I'm glad to say that, especially considering he's been around for 30 plus years. You know, obviously Steve Jackson kind of went that route a little bit with GURPS. They have a Megaversal game system, and a couple other companies have too. Over the years, I think people have gotten more flexible. I think that was the problem, is initially people were pretty rigid. And as other games came out, they realized you could do stuff. Like again, in the early 80s, I thought it was hilarious because you had a lot of people saying there were only two types of games you could have, fantasy and sci-fi. And that was because Traveller was out and was a successful science fiction-based role-playing game. And then you had D&D and RuneQuest, which were both very successful. And what really, I think, and they never get the credit they deserve on this, what to me, from my point of view, the thing that really shook up the energy in the industry was the release of Champions and Villains and Vigilantes. There were two comic book-based games that came out around the same time, and they both introduced different kind of game systems, and they just... I don't know. They just took off like crazy. And I think it showed people, hey, you can do things other than science fiction or fantasy. And we saw that, and we just kind of ran with stuff. I mean, one of the funny things was early on, I actually watered down my Palladium Fantasy game because it was a very, very specific world. And my distributors and most people in the industry at the time kept saying, no, no, you can't have a unique, specific world. It has to be very generic. And so in 1985, we come out with the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Other Strangeness, which is an instant mega hit. And a year later, we come out with Robotech, and that's our next big hit. And I sit back and I'm thinking, these worlds are about as specific as you can frickin' get, you know? And so this generic thing doesn't work. And that's when I started kicking around ideas for Rifts and some of our other games to make these very unique and dynamic world settings that weren't generic, that were unique environments unto themselves that you could just really run with. And yet at the same time, you can combine any of those elements in any game you wanted to run. So like you said, if you wanted to have a Ninja Turtle or other mutant animal fighting in the Robotech universe and they get rifted through space and time to Rifts, or to Heroes Unlimited, or any of those, you absolutely can do it. And it's a blast. And I love the broadness of that concept. I loved being able to have a game system that could accommodate, you know, pretty much anything you might want to play.
When I first heard about Rifts when I was in high school in the mid-90s, that's sort of what caught my attention with it. And I didn't start looking into Rifts until probably a couple of months ago. In fact, I was actually mentioning this to Jeff a couple of weeks ago. I managed to buy a ridiculously huge lot of Rifts books for like $25. I literally have like every world book up to like, I think 25 or something.
Wow.
Yeah. This guy's like, yeah, I'm getting out of the hobby. I'm like, yoink. And I look back at all the Rifts source books my buddy had during high school. I'm looking at them like thinking, hey, I recognize some of these. And the fact that the world is so huge and it's so open and you have created something so specific that, sure, you have to read it to get into it, but it's so large and so varied. What's it like to create a world from whole cloth that yet has so many different pieces that if you want to use it, you can, but if you don't want to, you don't have to?
I mean, for me, it's liberating. I get that question all the time. And in fact, the guys at Blizzard flew me in a few years ago to discuss world building. And it's funny, I didn't even think about it until someone there asked me the question of very much what you just asked is, what's it like to create this massive, you know, world that's been, you know, very much under your direct control and has gone on to be this big popular thing? And I was like, oh yeah, I guess it is this big popular thing, and I guess it really is this massive world because, you know, I'm just having fun with it really. So when a new idea hits me, and obviously I try to keep in, you know, continuity, and I listen to the fans and get ideas from them. You know, ultimately, for me, I'm one of those writers who I write to my audience. I love to know what people like, and I love to know what people want. So if someone or lots of someone has come up with ideas and say, man, we'd love to see this part of the world or that part of the world or this concept or that concept, and especially, you know, too bad no one can do something like this, that's always a challenge for me. I just kind of jump on it and play with it. It's funny because Plinian Fantasy was the game that started everything. So it's my personal favorite game to play. But Rifts is my favorite game to write. And I think largely because anything does go. And the cool thing about the Rift setting is that as a player, you don't have to know about the whole world. I mean, all those other source books and world books are there. And yeah, you could travel all over the place. You can even travel to other dimensions. But you can play whatever style of game and focus on whatever elements that you enjoy most in Rifts, whether that's a very narrowly focused game or whether it's a massive sprawling game. And I just love that. I think where that comes from, by the way, Mike, is during the Gaming Center days, I ran a very popular weekly game that I had to cut off at 26 people. So I think, you know, running 26 guys every Saturday night for like 8 to 10 hours at a time, my gaming style developed to be very flexible. You know, anything goes, roll with the punches, you know, riff on what your players are saying. And I think you see those elements in all of our games, but especially Rifts.
So now that you guys have got such a diverse catalog, that says stuff like Rifts, Robotech, you guys have also developed other games. Like there's stuff like Beyond Supernatural, but there's one in particular that you sent me, and I think you got in on this just as things were starting to hit huge. And that's the game called Dead Rain, which is basically your take on the zombie apocalypse, world destruction, whatever. And it's more set at a more human power level where I'm not dealing with giant robots, though if I wanted to bring them in, arguably I could. You guys hit it just as The Walking Dead and zombies were becoming a real thing in kind of Hollywood. So what kind of development went into making Dead Rain a unique zombie game? Because others had tried it before, like All Flesh Must Be Eaten. But I think it got to the point of being fantastic to where it kind of became kind of stupid. Whereas yours seems a little more based in, I'm not going to say reality, but you use different zombies from different genres. You got like the fast zombies, even the pretend zombies where they're actually, they look human, but they're not, sort of thing. And you've kind of tapped into a unique survival apocalypse setting. So what kind of work and development went into that game?
Well, that's sort of an interesting story because I never really thought of myself as a zombie guy, even though I really did like the zombie genre. And I was hugely influenced by meeting George Romero back in 1969 or 1970 at one of those Detroit comic book conventions. Really interesting guy, really generous of his time and talking about stuff. And, you know, he started out small and I could relate to that. And And I always watched all of his films, and I enjoyed zombies, but I never really thought of myself as a zombie guy. And one of my freelance writers, a gentleman named Josh Hilden, had been running this really popular within his group and at our Palladium open houses, this really popular zombie game that he was running. And he came to me one day and said, I really want to develop this. Would you be interested in publishing it? And I'm like, yeah, absolutely. So Josh spent like the next probably 2 years working on this stuff. And he is a zombie guy. He's a zombie nut. I think he's read everything and watched every film known to man, probably even including foreign versions of the genre. And he turned in his manuscript. And I had been seeing him play these games for years. We even had Josh at a Gen Con or two where he ran a bunch of Dead Rain games. And the manuscript he turned in, I think there was just something lost in translation. I think he had some brilliant ideas. They just weren't presented very well. And I think he went off on a tangent. You mentioned a more fantastical. His take on it was this more fantastical and kind of demon-based game. And I looked at that and said, you know what? This is not the game that I saw people going crazy about at conventions and in playtest. And I asked him if he wanted to rewrite it, and he said no. And I said, well, I'd like to take it and run with it. And he said, sure. And I ran with it. And it just was one of those games, and this happens from time to time, that just spilled right out of me. So it turns out, I guess I am a zombie guy, because just all these ideas just started to come out of me. And I came up with a lot of the variations. Some of those are Josh, some of those are mine. And, you know, I really, really developed the zombies in the world. And to me, much, in fact, ironically, I'm a big fan of The Walking Dead show. And I find it ironic that I think the approach I took of the role-playing game is very similar to what they take on that TV show, which is why I think both are very popular, which is the focus is not about the zombies. It's about the characters and how they deal with the apocalypse and how they survive and how they hang on to their own humanity. And that's the fun and beauty of the game and the fun and beauty of The Walking Dead TV show. Strangely enough, I've never really read the comics, but I love the TV show. And of course, Dead Rain came out before Walking Dead, I think.
Yep.
Yeah, I think we're both on kind of similar wavelengths. And that's what's fun about it. One of the things I really noticed in playtesting that I found pretty interesting about human nature is I playtested. I had the opportunity. I did a bunch of small conventions, so I had the opportunity to play test the game with people that I didn't know at all, you know, not my regular group of guys, just a total bunch of strangers. And it was interesting to me in that in most of these games at these conventions, most of the players didn't know each other either. So you're talking about playing total strangers, and just the whole dynamic of, I think, the zombie genre, but Dead Rain and shows and comics like Walking Dead. Human nature is that we must keep our fellow humans alive. And so it was fascinating to me to see people who never played before, didn't know each other, diving in with, and granted, they're fictional characters, to battle these zombies. I mean, there were playtests where a character is getting scooped up by a horde of zombies, and people are running out of ammunition, and they're jumping in and hitting them with their rifle butts and, you know, trying to pull the person away. And so, you know, you would think perhaps that they would, you know, just say, well, sorry, Bob, you're zombie meat, and run to save themselves. And I found that really fascinating about the human psyche, how in this game, people fight to save their fellow man. And I thought it was really cool. It was something I didn't really expect to see. And that's one of the fun things about being a game designer, is when your audience surprises you And that was one of those moments. And I was like, wow, this is really cool.
I think that's something that I definitely like as a player, too, is when you get a chance to work together with sometimes strangers. And surprisingly, your goals and theirs may actually be the same. And especially in zombie in zombie fiction, it tends to be every man for themselves and you band together only for survival. But I don't know, this sounds a little bit more hopeful than that. Like I said, going in to bash the guy's brain in when you know you could end up a zombie chow.
Well, it fits the way the game is set up. Or whether it's an aspect of humanity that, people miss, because I think we all assume everyone's going to be, you know, dog eat dog, but I'll tell you, in the playtest, it was, and in games that I've run since, it's no, we have to stick together. We're the last and we have to help each other, which I think is very positive and very hopeful and very nice to see.
Absolutely. Now, one of the questions I want to ask you just before we begin to kind of close this out is, recently you guys kind of, you went into a different direction when you guys started doing more stuff with the Robotech license, and normally it's the pen and paper RPG, and with the most recent version being involving the Shadow Chronicles, which came out a couple of years ago, but you guys did a Kickstarter a while back to do the RPG Tactics board game. What's that?
Well, that's, again, I think that goes back to me and Jeff and the rest of us at Palladium being fanboy geeks and just loving Robotech. We had the opportunity to create a game in which we would have the ability to create beautifully detailed miniatures as game pieces to play a more traditional strategy and tactics game with elements of role-playing in it. And we hooked up with the guys at Ninja Division, who are also Soda Pop Miniatures and Cypher Games. And we banged out this beautiful product. I mean, it was a monster to do. We weren't prepared for the amount of time and detail and work that had to be put to it to make it everything we wanted it to be. But I think the end result is a pretty damn fun game, and the miniatures are gorgeous, and it's fast, it's fun. It really captures the Robotech TV show. When we sat down to develop the rules for this particular game, I told the guys to forget everything they knew. I made them all watch Robotech, the TV show, again, the Macross part, and said, okay, now how do we translate this into a war game, tabletop game? And that's what we did. And, you know, some role-playing elements are there, and there's some familiar terms and some familiar approaches. But our goal was to create a very unique, fun, fast game that captured Robotech. And I think we did that.
So when you developed this board game, basically how do things differ from developing RPG rules into developing something that's actually played out on a physical play space?
Well, you know, a lot of the basic behind game theory and gameplay are still there. Certainly our approach, which is think about the players. So our two goals was, one, to make a game that was fun, and two, to make a game that emulated a TV show so that everyone who knew Robotech would say, wow, this is Robotech, and we're having a blast. And then, you know, as far as the actual rules, I mean, you know, they're a bit more, a lot less focus on story and character, a lot more focus on the action, the combat. You know, there's points and things that are involved because, you know, obviously people end up using this in tournament play and those kind of things. So that's very different. Because it's all really focused on the action and the abilities of each individual piece. You know, if it's a Veritech fighter or whether it's a Destroid, you know, it's all about the strategy and tactic versus character and story. Although you can incorporate some of those elements if you wanted to. But most traditional tabletop gamers and war gamers, you know, it's all about winning. It's all about I crushed the enemy or my opponent. And I'm victorious. And that's different than role-playing. But you just have to be aware of that going in and, you know, focus on that particular audience.
So I guess, Kevin, what is my final question is to you, what is coming up for Playdium in the near future?
Oh, gosh, we have a lot of stuff. We're mostly focusing on trying to get product out for our various game worlds. One of the downsides to having a big sprawling game line is that it's hard to support everything. You know, it's easy if your game line is D&D or X, you know, and that's all you really focus on. You know, when you have a dozen different settings, inevitably something or several somethings get left behind. So we're trying to go back and revisit a bunch of the stuff that we're doing. And of course, we really, really, really want to support and expand on Robotech RPG Tactics. That's our new big game. It's gorgeous. We want people to have a blast with it. And we have all kinds of big plans for that. We want to do every single generation of Robotech with all the unique mecha. We have more figures coming out for Macross, which is, of course, the most popular part of the series. We just got all kinds of great ideas for everything. And you'll be seeing that in the next couple of years, over the next few years.
So my question is, you guys have something going on in May that I'm actually very tempted to actually come down to because I'm only a few hours north of you guys. What is the Playdium Open House?
The Playdium Open House, and if you're thinking about it, Mike, you might want to do it because I'm not sure, as we expand, I'm not sure if we'll have space in our warehouse to do it again. We've done about five of them now, and every two or three years since like 2006, we've hosted what we call the Playdium Open House, which is basically a kind of mini convention that we hold inside of our warehouse. We bring in tables and chairs, and I invite all the Playdium creators to come in. So what makes the Playdium Open House really pretty amazing is we'll have 30 different Playdium creators plus the staff. So you get to meet all kinds of writers and artists, and they're there to talk to you. That's not like, you know, come and meet so-and-so for 1 hour right, between this time and that time. No, they're there most of the day into the night. A lot of these guys actually run games. So you get to play games with the actual people who make them. We get gamers from all around the world. I've got a gentleman coming in from Uruguay. I've got a couple or trio of guys coming in from Brazil. We usually have a couple of guys come in from Germany. We've had people come in from England and, of course, Canada, Spain, all over the place. So that amazes me. It always worries me, too, because I'm like, you guys are coming to this little – dumpy event, you know, you're playing in a warehouse, but people have a blast. And it's, you know, 3 days of nonstop Palladium gaming with the people who make the games. Plus, you know, I'm there the whole time from like 8 in the morning till midnight, and there'll be panel talks and, you know, stuff for sale and original art and
games going the whole time.
Well, now I have to find a way to convince my wife to drive me down. I think this would be an awesome way to spend a weekend. She's not a role player. She can go knitting or something.
Well, there's various stores and things in the area and a couple of movie theaters that are really close. But, Mike, so this is what I want to know. You don't drive?
It depends. I have a tendency to, let's just say me and the road don't necessarily get along all the time. I may or may not have gotten into a few accidents, and I may or may not suffer from road rage, but...
So your friends know you as Kamikaze Madman?
Pretty much. I mean, I'm not afraid to lean out the window and give them a piece of my mind. And when you've seen an angry fat man, this one, just no. But Kevin and Jeff, I gotta thank you guys for spending your afternoon with me to talk about Playdium, Robotech, Dead Range Rifts. It's been a blast, guys, and I sincerely wish you guys the best success in the future, and hopefully I'll see you guys in May for the Playdium Open House, because I think this is a fantastic event, and if people want to find out more information, where would they have to go to find out?
They can just go to the Playdium Books website, and it's easy to find. You'll see a big banner, and just click on it, and all the information's right there.
Well, guys, once again, thank you so much. I want you guys to hang the line for just a minute.
Sure thing.
Well, Well, guys, that was my interview with Kevin and Jeff over at Palladium Books. Wow. Got a real insight into what it was like to just be involved in that scene during the very early days when creativity was flowing, licenses are here, there, and everywhere. And like I said, they got some really cool stuff. So I'm excited to try and run one of these games for Terrible Warriors later on this year. Reading their world books, it's such an interesting look into a world that I think way deeper than D&D, because there's like a million different world books. Like literally, you could buy a different book each month for a year and you're not coming close to owning everything. So when I say there's a lot, I'm not kidding. So be sure to check these guys out. It's PalladiumBooks.com. They have their own web store there where you can check out all their other books and older properties as well. So give them a check out, guys. So until next time, I've been Mike the Birdman Dodd. This has been the new show, Botstroll. Hope you guys will join me next time. I'll catch you guys next time right here on ThisWeekInGeek.net.
Want to see me make bubbles with my spit?
Sure do. In fact, that's the theme of our next show.
So don't miss it.
What the hell happened to George Lucas?
Oh my God, there's snot on my face. And I'm your host, Mike the Birdman Dub. And I'm not a join. Not a join. What the f*** does that mean? F*** that. 10 seconds.
No, you gotta keep that.
Let's do this. Let's do this right the first time.
F*** you guys. Ew, it's in my mouth. Oh, God.
Oh, what's it taste like, Mike?
Water. Ew, salty.
Let's start this episode with shat.
Okay, I'm good, Geico.
Holy shit! Oh my gosh! Freak! Die! Holy crap! Whoa! Where did it go?
I'm like a stupid monkey.
As you can imagine, they don't let us out much.
You've been listening to This Week in Geek. Tune in next week to hear, somebody random. I don't know. Maybe even a hot chick. Yeah, let's go with that.
Did anyone ever tell you that you were very, very sexy?
How are you? Actually, no.
They never will.
Check out our website, thisweekingeek.net, for more geek content, as well subscribe to our podcast through iTunes or any podcatcher. If you'd like to comment on this episode, head to this episode post on thisweekingeek.net and comment through Facebook Connect. Or you can call our voicemail line at 817-717-7202. Send us a Twitter message by replying to @ThisWeekInGeek. Lastly, you can email us at feedback@thisweekingeek.net. This extra music was produced by Pronobozo at PronoBozo.com. We'll see you next time, and remember,
lower your shields and surrender your listenership.